ready to get started, Robert?
Oh, I'm going to go first. Okay. Hi, good morning. I'm Robert Ovetz. I'm a lecturer at San Jose State University. About a decade ago, I started writing this book, and I started doing the research. I was teaching a class on terrorism, and I started to look into how political violence was playing a role in U.S. labor movements in the end of the 18th century, and I came upon a problem that we've been struggling with, and I think if you were at that panel last night, you probably heard how deeply the struggle really is that I started to connect it with today and thinking about how essentially the global working class has a big problem, and that problem is that we're getting our asses kicked, and we're getting our asses kicked really badly. And I wanted to try to understand how previous periods of reform had happened, and that led me to circle back to the conflictual violence characterized labor movements at the turn of the 19th century. And we all know the problems of today, and I tried to think about how do we get to the point where we can start tipping the balance so that the balance of power is leaning towards the working class. We know all the problems that are happening today. The union density has declined significantly. Unions are harnessed to neoliberal parties. Unions are incredibly focused on issues of wages and benefits, ignoring the issues of work and power. Unions are pursuing member servicing rather than an interest-based bargaining. We know about many of these these shortcomings of the labor movement today. For example, unions talk about mobilizing. They don't really focus on organizing, or let alone escalating tactics and strategies or disruption. And there's almost no strikes. There's little strike-related activity. So how do we get to the point where we start to be able to organize in such a way that we tip the balance of power back in favor of the working class? So in starting to think about the role of political violence in these labor movements, I decided I wanted to focus on that period of time. And I asked myself two main questions about why I wanted to focus on the period of 1877 to 1921. The reason is more than just as a historical recounting of the huge movements and strikes that happened at that time. I had essentially three main questions. Two main questions. The first is, what is the relationship between reform and class struggle? How does class struggle trigger periods of reform? I think today we have it backwards. We tend to focus on, in the United States, on how reforms can help improve organizing of workers. And so I wanted to ask, look at this specifically in terms of how did labor law reform, did labor law reform drive class struggle, or did class struggle drive labor law reform? Which came first, essentially? And I drew the conclusion from looking at that period, and I'm going to talk about this in some more detail, that essentially labor historians of the United States, working class and labor movements, have it wrong. They have it backwards. That class struggle drives reform. Reform doesn't drive class struggle. I'm going to talk about why I come to that conclusion. The second other key question that I was asking when I was working on this book is, how do we tip the balance of power back in our favor? And to look at this, I delved into what folks from Notes from Below have kind of brought back to the forefront, which we refer to as workers' inquiry. I've long more referred to it as class analysis or class composition, but effectively it's the same kind of strategy. And this approach really informs how I looked back at this historical period. And it essentially asks to focus on four aspects. First, what is the existing class composition? In other words, how is capital organized? The second key aspect is, how is the working class organized? What is the working class composition? The third component is how can the working class recompose its power to tip the balance of power back in our favor in order not only to disrupt capital, but to be able to move beyond it. And then fourthly, the fourth aspect is how does capital decompose working class power? So I wanted to look at this period to see how these four different aspects could be understood. So in some ways, I'm not doing the kind of work that some of y'all are doing, looking at the contemporary movements and using working inquiry, but doing a kind of historical workers' inquiry for obviously more than a century later to try to understand and rethink how class struggle has driven changes in these aspects of capitalism. And I also focused on what I call the trajectory of political violence, is when do workers escalate their tactics and strategies, under what conditions do these happen, and then how can they use the escalation of tactics and strategy in order to disrupt and to transcend capitalism. So it's not just a kind of historical reencountment in any means. It's an attempt to look at it strategically and tactically. How did workers organize, self-organize during this time period in order to disrupt and attempt to go beyond capitalism, which is not the case for each of these movements. So what came out of this over the past 10 years is essentially what I think of as a retrospective workers' inquiry of how did the working class self-organize between 1877 and 1921. And it begins with 1877 because that's an incredibly important time period. It's the end of Reconstruction. It's really the beginnings of the emergence of large capitalist conglomerates that at the time were called trusts in the United States. And most importantly, it was kind of a calling card of the industrial working class. That year, 1877, was the huge railroad strike that shut down more than half of the entire country and effectively was put down by state militias, which preceded the National Guard in the military. And it ends, and the end point of 1921 is the period of the Workers' Army in West Virginia. West Virginia's gotten a lot of attention this year because of the teachers' wildcat strike there. But that period itself was also the emergence of the miners' movement, and it ended with literally an armed battle on Blair Mountain. So I thought that was a good way to kind of end that period because what follows is the counter-movement of the 1920s, the decomposition of working class struggle until the 1930s. So in looking at these different time periods, I came to these other questions that I wanted to ask about these particular movements, because they've gotten a lot of attention. There's a lot of books written about these different strikes that I looked at during this time period. The strike of 1877, the 1894 railroad strike, which also shut down much of the country, the miner strike in 1900-1902, and the wildcat strike wave during World War I, and the general strike of Seattle, and then also West Virginia. So in looking at these specific periods of class struggle, I asked these other questions. What role does tactical escalation play in recomposing working class power? So how can workers not just self-organize, but how can they use an escalating repertoire of tactics and strategies in order to recompose their power? The second question that I asked specifically about these periods was, these movements during this period was, how did the working class make the last cycle of struggle in order to achieve the gains of what we call the Fordist era? The Fordist era being, in short, the Keynesian wage productivity deal. Wages will rise if productivity rises along with it. We tend to situate that in the 1930s. I think that the labor historians have gotten it wrong. It happened a lot earlier. And then thirdly, how, as I mentioned before, how does reform happen? Reform in terms of the way that the state manages capitalism and the way that the state, and also the way that the state manages the working class. And then what role does reform play in managing class struggle as well? So the answer that I came to was essentially that working class organized, it escalated its tactics and strategies, and it disrupted. And between this period between 1877 and 1921 was a period in which capital had innovated new technological composition. The industrial firms that I talked about, in other words, a concentration of capital. then I also observed how working class organized, intensified tactics and strategies, and escalated along a trajectory of violence, which in these different periods, workers had gone as far as not just mobilizing and organizing, but also even taking up arms in self-defense, and to the point in 1921, actually engaging in a kind of pitched battle. And this had the effect of disrupting the capital accumulation process, and then was followed in each wave of this time period with capital decomposing working class power, and doing this by making significant concessions in order to buy time to impose new organizations of capital and new organizations of work, expanding the role of the state in the marketplace, and introducing new technology, a new technical composition of capital. Also, in innovating ways to integrate labor unions into the capitalist accumulation process in order to restore capital accumulation. So each of these case studies in the book are really this study of the technical composition, working class recomposition, taxes and strategies, and then on capital-specific response in order to decompose the power of the working class. So just to kind of wrap it up, I came to a number of lessons that we can apply today to understand how and why we're losing so poorly, and how we can actually introduce many of the we can bring about many of the attempts to achieve reforms that some have been advocating for, and that includes. First, looking at how escalation of tactics and strategies is crucial, even to the level of the use of political violence, are crucial to recomposition of working class power. Second, that reform follows working class recomposition, and also that there are two meanings of reform. We hear a lot about reform without really hinging it in a kind of historical materialist concept of the way that class conflict happens. Reform, I think, occurs in two different types. First, that there's reform for capital. Reform becomes a disciplinary tool. For example, introducing labor laws that allow workers to organize, that mandate mandatory arbitration, that impose mandatory arbitration on capital, such as what happened in World War I, is an early form of prior to the New Deal period. These are disciplinary strategies. This is a means of harnessing workers to the accumulation process. And second, that reform can mean something different to the working class. That reform becomes a means to reach a new terrain, a new level in which workers can situate their new power in order to develop new forms of struggle, to move to the next terrain of struggle. So I think that this raises a number of questions about also how we conduct workers' inquiry today, that we need both contemporary and historical workers' inquiry. Is that a fire alarm?
Oh, it's just test.
Oh. it's a shock to the system test. So I think, I think what we need to also make as a complementary effort to contemporary workers' inquiries is we need to rethink these historical periods as well, and that's the intent of this book. I think that there's a possibility of doing great work of workers' inquiry from below, and I'm doing it in higher education, for example. But I also think that workers' inquiry from above, looking back at these different historical periods, to question some of the common notions that we have about these previous periods is also important, because I think in many ways labor historians and the left have gotten it wrong about how these reforms that have pushed us to a new terrain of struggle actually come about. And I think we have to also conduct a class analysis of the balance of power and look at how strategies and tactics play an important role as well in how to do that. And so there's a lot of lessons that I take away from this history of workers' inquiry, of facing reality and socialism at Barbary or Zero Work, Midnight Notes, Red Notes, League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and from Notes from Below, which is inspiring, and I'm glad to contribute to that that growing tradition.
Thank you so much, Robert. So now we're going to have Akile give us his...
Yeah. You all have any questions, or if there's something you disagree with, just say it, because there's a few of us. So in his book, Robert writes about how, well, the loss of union density in the past few years has obviously in some ways been a tragedy. At the same time, workers are less and less subject to those rules that were erected during the Fordist era. So Robert writes, these rules that were made to manage and harness class struggle. So Robert writes, no union, no rules. As in 1877, so in 2017. 140 years later, a lot looks very similar. Today I'm talking about one case today in which things are very similar. In particular, the struggle of food delivery platform workers, which in the past few months I've come to be involved in through the London IWW. And just as a warning, this is not really an academic paper, but like a reflection on this organizing process. And hopefully we can offer some thoughts on the class composition today. And also we can reflect on some of the tactical uses of violence in the same way that Robert does in his book, and also how workers' inquiry can play a role in working class organization. How much time do I have, by the way?
15 minutes, you can go a little bit longer if you want to.
2 minutes, okay. Yeah. So, for those who don't know, on September 20th, food delivery platform workers working for Uber Eats went on 3 days of wildcat strike, organized outside of any trade union organization. And it was in response to Uber Eats slashing the minimum payment per delivery. Before, they used to be paid a minimum of $4.80 per delivery, then it varied by distance and so on, kind of food delivery. And they slashed it to £2.50 per delivery. So almost immediately, the next day, hundreds and hundreds of workers went on strike, logged off the app, and went to demonstrate in front of the Uber offices in Goldgate in East London. This is not the first time that these workers have gone on strike. There's been a number of strikes across Europe and actually the world. And in Europe, they began in August 2016 in London with the first Deliveroo worker strike. And it's worth noting that most of these workers work for both Deliveroo and Uber Eats and other companies at the same time, switching between them on the app, depending on which one is busiest, or sometimes even working, keeping both apps on at the same time. So we know that the expansion of this industry has come with the expansion of workers' struggle with a very high degree of autonomy. And this is not the place to talk completely about that history, but there are some elements of why the struggles of these workers are so autonomous. So the first one is, of course, that they're, as comrades have taught us, their legal status as private contractors means that they're not bound by the current anti-trade union law. So a whole series of tactics which have been taken out of the arsenal of the labor movement, such as wildcat strikes. Wildcat strikes become possible. Flying pickets, which is when you move from workplace to workplace doing pickets, are legal for these workers, and so are solidarity strikes. Like, in theory, these workers who, most of their deliveries are for McDonald's, 80% of Uber's deliveries are for McDonald's, they could go on strike in order to support demands of McDonald's workers and put pressure on McDonald's like that, and that would be illegal because they're private contractors. Like we said before, no union, no rules. Secondly, these are workers who have a very high degree of unity in their conditions. The industry hasn't yet developed stratifications. So they're more or less all equal. They all receive the same pay per delivery. Not many of them are, you know, they're all private contractors and so on. The only differences between the workers tend to be their means of subsistence in doing this work. So the vast majority of them in London are moped drivers, but there are also bicycle couriers, and actually in other UK and European cities it's mostly bicycle couriers, and also car drivers. And that was very important during the strike, this differentiation, because the ones who do deliveries by car, that's a very, it's very unprofitable because the costs are so high with gas and so on. And there are people who had other jobs and then on the way home would do some deliveries in order to top it up. So it was the moped drivers who were the most militant who began the strike, and these car drivers who didn't depend on it, on this work so much, kept on breaking the strike. And this led to violence, as I'll talk about in a minute. And actually, I would be interested in knowing where, in the period that you're analyzing, were workers a bit more equal before the work, before the assembly line? And were stratifications developed more during the Fordist period? Would you say that's the case?
No, I wouldn't.
They're already stratified.
Yeah, well, in a lot of, during the process of industrialization, you had craft workers who still
right.
control significant aspects of the production
mm-hmm.
process, their own work tempo, their own wages and output.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of stratification and disputes and conflicts between these workers.
Mm-hmm. So that's one way in which this is very different from that.
Yeah.
Because these workers are almost completely massified. Their labor is very, we could say, abstract. They have no like direct connection to the work. Well, they do, but not to a much lesser extent. This is also, there's another level of autonomy in the sense that the workers are very autonomous from the company because they don't have managers on their backs in the same way that restaurant workers or cleaners would, harassing them all the time. So they don't have that fear that is instilled by management. And finally, the work itself is very individual, but actually these workers are concentrated physically in the various McDonald's, because as I said, McDonald's is the number one contractor for Uber Eats.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find when you go to major McDonald's all over London, you find dozens of delivery drivers hanging out there and chatting while they wait on the downtime, and they talk about, you know, how many deliveries there are, problems with the work and so on. So these were the places where solidarity was generated during downtime. And also more solidarity. And I should mention also that these workers were also concentrated digitally through WhatsApp groups, even though these were mostly limited to different areas or different nationalities and ethnicities. But it was the WhatsApp groups which allowed for the organization of these wildcat strikes. One more point is that this is very dangerous street-based night work. So workers are always under the threat of first violence and theft, but especially the theft of their primary means of subsistence, especially the motorbike. You know, you have insurance on that, but you know, you bought it on a paper month scheme and you have to keep paying if your bike is broken and then you can't work, so you lose. You lose your income. And this has created a necessity for a degree of organized self-defense. You can find a lot of news stories on, what are they called? Tabloid newspapers of riders like showing up en masse at a thief's house and beating them up and finding all the parts of their motorcycle. And this, what this does is basically it creates connections between drivers and solidarity. And also what it shows is a willingness to take, well, a necessity, but also a willingness to take things into their own hand, precisely because state recourse is inefficient, expensive, ineffective, and in many cases, as a lot of these workers are on irregular papers, end up getting the worker in trouble instead of the thief. So as I said, these workers already possess a high degree of self-organization and militancy. And organizing was pretty much just a matter of organizing militants into different geographical groups, and each of us went to various McDonald's in our area and talked to drivers, and we would find the most militant ones and the ones who promised to give leaflets and to enforce the strike and to use their pre-existing networks. And that was it. In most places there wasn't too much convincing or arguing to be done on the question of going on strike. Mm. So on the question of violence, during the strike on the 20th, they employed a number of different tactics which could be considered violent, not in the moral sense of the word, but simply objectively. And we can divide these into three groups. The first is a form of sabotage, in which couriers accepted orders on their app but didn't deliver the orders. So the bags of McDonald's food would just accumulate on the McDonald's counter. And yeah, workers in one McDonald's in North London told me that they thought that this would be much more effective than simply logging off, because then it wouldn't just be Uber and McDonald's would be angry, but the customers who had ordered the food but couldn't receive it. But in that McDonald's, what ended up happening is the manager called the police and all the workers had to run away, so this tactic was not employed by them in the second strike, which was organized by us. A second form of violence is the enforcement of the strike by the more militant section of the workers. So in this case, the violence was not directed towards the commodities, towards the goods, but towards other workers. This ranged a lot from physically blockading the McDonald's and threatening scabs, to slashing tires in some places, or more commonly, locking scabs' bikes so that they simply couldn't work. there are a lot of videos that the workers were sending to us of like them locking people's bikes and laughing at them. In other cases, there were actual physical altercations against the scabs, with the scabs, and the police ended up getting involved in a lot of McDonald's. The final and third form is the disruption of public order, particularly simply blocking the traffic. During the first strikes, they had this big demonstration from the Uber HQ, and basically they blocked the road for how many hours? Like
2-3.
Yeah, until the police told them to go away, right? Yeah, so as you can see in Robert's book, these forms of violence have a long history in the workers' movement. The extreme cases shown in his book would be the steelworkers' bombing campaign of sabotage, which would be an example of sabotaging commodities and infrastructure, and also exchanging gunfire with scabs. But fundamentally, the essence is the same. But the point is that we shouldn't be moralizing or to see it as like the result of these violent individuals, or even like seeing it in a psychological origin of saying like, oh, it's because these workers have such violent work, or you know, they come from slums in Brazil, therefore they're violent. No, the workers, they're reasoning completely about this, like, oh, we should do this because it's more effective. If people are going to work, we're going to lose the strike, we have to lock their bikes. They also had a bit of fun doing it, but like, that was the reason. But again, also we should consider that, which is something that Robert hints at in his book, that violence between workers during strikes is also, in some cases, violence can also be a substitute for working class power and solidarity, and that is definitely the case in the Uber Eats strike, especially in the violence between those divisions of the car workers and the moped workers and the bicycle workers.
Mm.
So the strikes, the original strikes, organized by the workers themselves, called by the workers themselves, did not achieve their demands, which was £5 per drop, but it did force the Uber to offer a guarantee, a payment guarantee during peak hours that they would make at least £9 an hour, and like on Friday and Saturday night they would make £11 an hour. But that guarantee has been called off on November 4th. It was only going to last for a month, and now drivers are really pissed off again. Not just because the guarantee has gone down, but also there's something called Boost, which is like you get paid per delivery, but then whenever Uber sees that not enough drivers are working in order to deliver their commodities, they'll say, okay, now you're going to get a 1.6 times boost, which means that everything you earn in this time is multiplied by 1.6. And since in the recent period, of course, during the strikes, Uber raised the boost. You know, it's not just an economic issue, it's a political issue of getting workers out there. They raise the boost when it's raining and hailing, because they're bastards, and they raise the boost when workers are on strike in order to try to break their solidarity. And in some cases, it is successful. So the boost has been going down now that the workers have stopped struggling. So workers are getting angry again, and hopefully it'll lead to another wave of organizing. Another point to make is that the source of the anger that led to these strikes was not just what happens in the workplace itself and the pay. Because actually, in some case, this is probably not the lowest paid job in this country yet. Other workers who are paid less and who maybe face more difficult conditions aren't struggling. But I would say, in addition to all the reasons that we outlined at the beginning, there's also the problem of the fact that in London, unlike in other European UK cities, most of these workers are migrants who drive mopeds and for whom delivery is the only available form of income, and who are essentially locked or caged inside this sector. They're unable to find any other jobs. And so they actually work for a number of different companies, but they're all delivery companies, and they all can't get any other kind of jobs. And the reasons for these are, first of all, the fact that if you're on irregular papers, if you're on irregular documents, you can simply work on somebody else's account. And it's actually accepted by these companies, because if you're a private contractor, that's what you can do, you can subcontract. And so you don't have a manager checking whether you have papers or not. It's the duty to check whether in regular papers is on the person who has the account. So you can get past that. Sometimes they use family members' accounts, other times they'll actually have these middlemen who take a portion of their wages, so they make even less. And this was also a dynamic within the strike that we didn't completely understand, because of course workers can't talk about it too openly. The second, of course, is the lack of English. You don't need to speak English to be a delivery driver. And all of this, and also the sector is completely dominated by recent waves of migrants, especially Brazilians, to a smaller extent Algerians, but also even British citizens who, for example, mainly people of color, Bengalis, Pakistanis, who just simply experience racism in the labor market and can't get any other jobs for that reason, even if some of them have degrees from this country. But also, we shouldn't overstate the constriction. There's also the fact that a lot of these workers enjoy the independence of doing delivery work and don't want to be a cleaner or a restaurant worker with a manager yelling at them all the time. I'll end by simply just emphasizing this fact that, like the workers in Robert's book, the reason why these workers are forced into these militant forms of action is because all other avenues for them are blocked. Those who are on irregular documents can't rely on the state for help. And again, the point of being a private contractor, there is no union recognition or collective bargaining in the sector. just like the railway workers or metal workers in Robert's book. Just to end on the question of workers' inquiry. So what we ended up doing after the Wildcat strikes is we were contacted by a small group of couriers, and we proposed to them to organize a national strike on October the 4th to coincide with the strike of fast food workers and Wetherspoons workers. And the strike was more or less successful. Hundreds of workers in London, actually thousands of workers in the UK, couriers went on strike, but they didn't employ the same degree of militant tactics, probably in large part because of the demoralization of the fact that the previous wave of strikes didn't really achieve their demands. But our next step is that we'll be producing a workers' paper to distribute in the various McDonald's. And the way we see the role of workers' inquiry here, and very inspired by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers that Robert mentioned, is for militants to be what has been called the post-workers of the struggle, which is to say that whenever a struggle happens, whenever one section of the class, either geographically certain McDonald's, is more militant, we want to spread those actions to the rest of the class and emphasize and give a platform to those militant actions, including militant actions internationally. For example, in Paris, just a few weeks ago, they threatened to blockade these Deliveroo dark kitchens, which are these containers where they put cooks to make food, which only gets delivered by Deliveroo. Nobody sits there to eat, right? That's what they want to do. They want to replace restaurants. So we're going to put that in the paper, and we want to tell writers here that happened. And also, for example, in one McDonald's that we visited in North London, the drivers there got together to ban fake GPS, which some workers were using a fake GPS in order to use more accounts and to get more orders. And they basically came together in solidarity and banned it. And this increases the unity between the workers. We want to promote that across London. That is everything.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Okay, so what I thought we would do now is we have plenty of time for comments, discussion, comments that sound like discussion and so on. But what I wanted to start off with, I think Akile, you did a fantastic job of connecting some of this to what's happening in the UK. But there were a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about the book as well, Robert, which I quite like how you framed it in terms of historical inquiries being inquiries from above. So thinking about how we look back into the past in various ways. And I guess, Akile has put it into conversation with today, but, you know, we went to the panel on US labour last night, which some people here might have gone to as well. What do you think the kind of key learnings from an inquiry from above, kind of telescoping back historically, how can that help to inform, you know, for example, the wave of teacher struggles in states which had many of these histories that you've spoken about? So my first question is, what are the things we can kind of extract from that history for today in terms of the specifics in the US? And then the other question that I wanted to ask was around thinking of the different components of class composition. So thinking about the classical, technical and political, which it sounds like the book focuses on how technical composition has an effect on the different forms of struggle that workers make. But perhaps one of the significant shifts from the period you've been talking about today is also around social composition, how workers are composed outside of the workplace. So I wondered if you could offer some commentary around how we think of the social composition of workers from then and now. But I'd also like to open it up to everybody else for questions, comments, and so on.
Are you going to answer that first? Oh, do you want me to go first? Or
also, great for people to have a chance to pitch in, and then we can bring people in. But if there are any other questions for now?
Okay, well,
we have one from Joe at the back.
Oh, okay.
One from me. This one's about Achille's presentation. Now, you might have mentioned it before I came in. But I was wondering, with you had the strike that was organized by the workers, and then the strike that you helped organize. Could you, were there any differences in that organizational form? What did it look like? One that was totally self-organized by workers, and one that had outside activists assisting.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any differences in what that strike form looked like, is my question.
Yeah, I mean, Robin, if you want to come back first, there's something to respond to from Achilles, and then we can start drawing things out.
Okay. Well, I didn't have the one, but I think it's more of a kind of thing to think about. I've been wondering in these questions of wildcat strikes and different leftist tactics, like how do we deploy the word of violence? Could it be broken down? Are there, because I mean, like for the liberal press, liberal opinion, it's such a dangerous word. It as this anarchist theoretician, I forget his first name, Gelderlos, has been arguing that there really is no definition of violence. In fact, it can be used to various purposes and ends, and in fact, it should. If there would be a convenient way to break it down for tactics and strategies in these struggles, that would be great, because then it would be not so alarming for the general opinion like that.
Okay. I think I'd like to respond to your first question, Jamie. Of how we can extract the lessons for today. And I think that you know, last night's panel was a really good example of how the lessons of this nearly five decades really applied to today. And I think one thing that really stands out is, I think a lot of the focus of that panel last night was about, and a lot of the focus on the labor movement in the United States right now, and working class struggle, is that wave of wildcat strikes of the teachers that happened in 6 states in Puerto Rico. We often forget about Puerto Rico. And actually, it's kind of winding down right now, but there's actually a strike happening in Washington State, and which is leans heavily Democratic, high union density, versus the other states where union density, except Colorado, is extremely low. And I think that could be one of the main lessons we can learn. Is that, and I'm glad you know you brought up what I wrote in the introduction: no union, no rules. Because where we do have high union density, where we do have a lot of workers who have in the public sector union contracts, where unions are relatively well organized and workers are, you could say, organized. There's virtually no self-organization. There's no real class conflict going on. It's because the labor laws that exist and the harnessing of the unions to the Democratic Party has essentially fragmented and divided workers from being able to not only confront issues other than wages and benefits, but actually to assert power over working conditions, over contingency, over productivity issues. And in those states where they're ununionized, they've actually have fewer impediments that are preventing them from organizing. There's many studies that are going on, many observations going on about how those workers in West Virginia and Oklahoma did it using social media. But the other thing that they did was the old-fashioned way. They set up members in every school and every district in some of those states, and they did face-to-face organizing. And there were really virtually no unions there to direct them and drive them into collective bargaining and arbitration and grievances. They organized directly with themselves. And this is, this is what I found over and over again in this time period, starting with 1877, and even to the miners' army, even where there was a miners' union in West Virginia, it didn't even cover many of the counties where most of the miners' army was engaged in confrontation with the companies. The union virtually didn't exist. The miners were able to organize in their communities. Because they were so integrated with each other, the families knew each other, they were also extremely isolated regionally and geographically, that they formed their own decision-making process, their own organizational means. And then the union kind of came in and kind of gave a voice to it, which is essentially a kind of similar scenario of what's happened with some of the teachers, is the unions kind of stepped in and said, well, we've got, you know, the resources, we're not going to direct you, but, you know, we'll provide some sort of process of spreading the word beyond the rural mining areas. So there's a lot of analogies in places where in sectors at that time, over this time period, where there were unions, they were AFL unions, they were very very much opposed to striking. They were very much opposed to any militant tactics and strategies. And they were beginning to be harnessed to the Democratic Party. And so a lot of the analogy, you know, there's a very strong analogy between then and today. And I find that the low rate of unionization actually didn't negatively impact the workers' ability to shut down the railroad industry twice in less than two decades. It actually facilitated it because they didn't have unions that were trying to drive them into making concessions and looking for changes in laws. So I think they're, you know, I think I'm quite hopeful about the low rate of union density, and I think that one reason why I'm hopeful about that is because in West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona, where they don't have any legal right to collectively bargain or to strike, let alone that, there's no conception that they would be breaking the law because they have no formal union. So there are no official legal sanctions for organizing. And I think you mentioned some references, you made some references to that as well for these subcontractors, if I understood right, that the subcontractors are able to engage in sympathy strikes and disrupt other sectors. Well, if you were in a union, the union would be sanctioned, the leaders would go to prison, everybody would be like, oh, we can't let our leaders go to jail, so we can't do it, right? So you're free of the threats and the risks and the costs of struggling and organizing. So I think there's a lot of analogies that can be made about how now we're actually, many of the tactics that you talked about that these workers use are not really any different than what was used during this time period. It's just that we're rediscovering them. Because for, I don't know about so much about England, but in the US for 70 years, we've been under the Wagner Act. We've been under, for 40 years, under state labor relations laws that tell us this is what you can do and this is what you can't do. And because many workers don't have unions, they don't worry about what's legal and what's illegal. So we're, in some ways, there's kind of a kind of re-innovation around what can be done, because no one has the conception that if we do it, there'll be costs. And then your second question about the different components of the technical and social compositions. I think there's a couple of cases that really stand out in that I focused on that were really, really fascinating about how you can see these differences. In 1877, for example, and there's a lot of analogies to some of the things that you talked about the delivery workers are doing, is that in 1877, the strike began in a little town called Martinsburg, West Virginia. And the reason was some of the companies had started to do double headers. In other words, they doubled the number of trains that the workers were responsible for. And so they essentially doubled productivity, right? Which meant their wages went down by half. The workers just spontaneously said, we're not going to get on this train, we're not going to drive it. The militia couldn't force them to get on the trains and drive it. And then what did they do? They got on the trains, and they went from town to town, and they spread, they used capitals, and then the railroads ran the telegraphs. So along the train lines, you had telegraph wires. And so the workers went from station to station, and they spread the word, and they made up little newslets, new leaflets reportedly. None have been preserved, unfortunately. But they passed out leaflets, and they would bring them from train depot to train depot, and it spread from one company to the other. In that point, there were hundreds of railroad companies, literally, around the country. Kind of like the way the British train system emerged after Protestantism. And so they spread the word of mouth, and they would visit different depots. there was a union. It had been crushed. They called a strike a few weeks earlier, but no one showed up because it had been infiltrated and a bunch of the organizers had gotten arrested. But the workers went on with it anyways. They called a second strike, and they just did it. And they spread using the technological means that capital had put into place. But what was the consequences of that? After 1877, the way that capital tried to put down the strike was they called out the militias. There was a little problem, though. Many of the militias were composed of working class men, and they knew many of the strikers. So a lot of them refused to confront them. They actually went home many times, or they gave their guns over to people. In Pennsylvania, the Philly militia was sent into Pittsburgh because the Pittsburgh militias wouldn't show up. And when the Philly militia showed up, they started shooting people, and people were being killed for people sitting on a hill were watching the events. And they shot up into the crowd and killed a bunch of people. And so the Pittsburgh militia gave out their guns to the people. And they responded to the Philly militia and drove them out of town. And the general who was in charge just went home and said, I'm not going to run this militia. They couldn't find him anymore. And so the response to that was the elites in many of the big cities and states where the strike was most intense disbanded the militias entirely, and they went to Congress and they said, and also the army was really small because that year Congress didn't pass funding for the military. They had come back from fighting Native Americans, they were coming back from the South, and the former Confederates just refused to fund the military. It was a kind of remnant of Reconstruction. And so they went to Congress and they not only funded the military, but they passed a National Guard Act. And they dismantled the militias and they made them into professional National Guards. They also created municipal police because many of the police worked on tips. And I like to tell, you imagine the police working on tips. It's called bribery, right? So the police, there were virtually no police. Many of the sheriffs hid in their houses. They refused to go out to confront the crowds. Some of the largest cities had a few dozen cops. So they reorganized the police. That's when professional municipal police came into being in the United States. Also, I talked about the telegraph. The telegraph was replaced by the telephone. Over the next decade, they rationalized the police, so that the police had to go from station to station, and they had to call in every time they got to their station, so they always knew where the police were. And so the telephone was actually introduced as a way to control the police, and the only people who put phones in their homes were rich people, so they could call the police, and so they always knew where the police were going to be, and so the police now became a force to fight against the working class. So I think the two of the most fascinating changes in the technical composition of capital after 1877 was the National Guard and the police were created. They also did other things too. They started using paddy wagons because then the paddy wagon carried a lot of police and they could move very quickly. They could smash through crowds. Before that, the police walked on foot. And so it took forever to get the police to one place or the other. So now they had these horse-drawn paddy wagons and they would just literally drive them as weapons into parades and marches. And then you also asked about the social composition of capital. And I think the iron worker strike that you referred to, where they bombed the union itself, set up a kind of guerrilla campaign where they strategically bombed some of the companies that refused to grant them their demands. There were far more actual bombs set off by the iron companies and steel companies themselves. They were false flag operations, most of them. But one reason why they were so successful with that was, even though many of the leaders of that bombing campaign went to prison, the union grew. Their wages tripled, I think it was. And they were incredibly popular. And the reason was because the workers and their families and communities realized that They had no other options. Both major political parties were opposed to them. U.S. Steel had essentially controlled the iron sector, and they weren't going to be able to use collective bargaining. They weren't going to be able to strike to succeed. And everybody knew, it wasn't much of a hidden secret, that the union was engaging in these militant attacks on the industry, and they were still incredibly popular, even though the union president was in prison. He kept getting re-elected as president. And so, you know, this kind of demonstrates that the social composition of the workers was that they had the kind of cohesive, integrated communities of support, that they realized that the tactics and strategies that they chose were the ones that were most effective for defending their interests, even though they really didn't have the kind of organizing power that they needed in order to win. They used the tactics and strategies that was still considered very valid for the workers in that sector. And then kind of getting to your question about breaking down violence, I kind of glossed over that earlier in my opening comments, but in the book, I go into a lot of detail about how we can see violence as not a singular static tactic, but really it's a repertoire of tactics, and I refer to it as an escalation, because I think violence really is, you know, it's a loaded term, right? And a lot of people have asked me, why do you use violence? Because I think it's important to break it down and recognize that violence is force, right? And there are different levels of force. And so one of the things that I do in each of these cases is look at how and we're learning this lesson again in some ways, and I think the examples that you gave are a good one, is that we slowly ratchet up the level of force in response to certain conditions that we face. For example, if there's broad support for the organizing campaign, and let's say the employer is refusing to respond at all, to engage, you slowly ratchet up that force. And you ratchet it up as long as you have enough mass support among the workers and the community. And if the organizing campaign is seen as legitimate and credible, and is seen as, you know, and there's a lot of support for your demands, ratcheting up your support can actually build support. It builds you sympathy. It gets more workers involved. And so there's always this kind of sense, there's also always this delicate kind of balancing between opportunities and risk, right? So if you have the, and you only know this in your own circumstances, but if your circumstances show that you have broad support and you're seen as having, let's say, the morally righteous side in the fight, and you ratchet up your support, you can actually build support. But if you lack mass support, and you ratchet up the level of force, you can actually lose support. And one of the things that happened with the iron workers, I think, in some degree, was they didn't really have support beyond their own limited sector. And they were isolated. They didn't seek out workers in other sectors to circulate their struggle. And so when they escalated their support, they lost support around the country. And so internally, they had a lot of social cohesion, but externally, they were isolated. And by the way, that repertoire of force, I draw on a sociologist by the name of Charles Tilly for that. And so Tilly has, you know, he's written a lot about this repertoire of tactics, and I think there's also a repertoire of violence. And so, you know, I think some of the things you talked about, I would say, are at the lower level of force, right? So, you know, not picking up the food, that's violence against property, right? That's a disruption of the process. But then there's also, you know, cases where in 1877, the Miners' Army in West Virginia in the 1920s, early 20s, they used a higher level of organized violence as self-defense. And of course, beyond that, you can go beyond that to where the workers were actually engaging in hit-and-run attacks, you know, targeting companies that were carrying out, you know, violence against the communities, and, you know, in some ways, even, you know, the iron workers, you know, cells that carried out these kind of propaganda by the attacks. So I think there's a whole trajectory. You have to look at what level of force is involved. And it has to happen within a context of understanding the working class's composition.
Brilliant. Okay.
Yeah, just in relation to that and to answer Joe's question. So the difference in organization was, I didn't really explain it in depth, but the original strikes were mostly organized through WhatsApp,
mm-hmm.
as well as through flying pickets. What we did in large part was set up a new WhatsApp group, and where we added the most militant drivers that we met, and also we drivers would always add us to their WhatsApp groups, which, you know, loads of them were like memes and bullshit and like jokes in Portuguese that I don't understand. On strike days, they became like, you know, organizing platforms that had a lot of discussion during the strike. And so there was, it wasn't that different because we still use those platforms. But it's true that I think in part what happened, apart from demoralization from the failure of the previous strikes, they saw, okay, now there's a union doing this stuff. Now we don't have to do it as much. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They kind of offloaded the responsibility to us. They're very, very grateful. They said, oh, thank you so much for doing this. And then they went home. And then some of them would text me like, hey, what's going on? I saw a guy delivering on Green High Street. I said, yeah, why don't you stop him, you idiot? What do you think we're going to do? Talk to every single driver in London. And but also, I forgot to mention a very important point. And so this question of de-escalation. So Robert gives these different stages. So the lowest one is like petitions, and like lawsuits, strikes, sabotage, guerrilla warfare, terrorism, something like that. And basically, a lot of unions have come into contact with these workers. A lot of them have tried to organize them. Now, these workers' tactics that they've come up with them by themselves are already here, right? Strikes and sabotage.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the union's response has been to do petitions and lawsuits, right? And the other thing that the unions want to do, they said, oh, join us, pay dues every month to become a union member, and we'll ballot you for strike. They want to put workers back into that constrictive,
yeah.
into those boundaries, right? Or join us and we'll sue Uber for you and we'll change the law and make you direct employees. And driver's response is, you know,
that.
Number one, like, I don't have any papers. If I'm a direct employee, I'm fucked. I'm gonna get deported.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, like, I, to some extent, enjoy being a private contractor. Like, look at all this freedom it gives me. I can go wildcat strike. Like, so what the IWW has done, and this, I think, began in the IWW Cardiff branch. Am I right, Jane?
I think so, yeah.
Is set up what's called the IWW Couriers Network. And that's a place, an organization, where you don't have to pay to be a member of. But at the same time, what it does is it brings the workers' self-organization, their extra union organization, within the field of the union, and it allows the union to recruit some of the more militant workers who understand the need to be more organized,
mm-hmm.
you know, who understand what a union is in a long-term sense,
yeah.
And I think this is the way forward for the gig economy for sure, and perhaps in the future for other sectors.
Thank you, Kile. Do we have any other comments or questions from the floor?
I have something that I wanted to mention.
Mm-hmm.
That it was really interesting what you talked about, how some of these workers are trapped in this sector, and also about how some of the workers are using other people's papers, I think, if I understood that right, so that they could work, right?
They might use their identity. They're using their accounts.
Yeah.
So they're working on
right.
the app
yeah.
on somebody else's
right.
account. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually did that in the Netherlands when I moved there because I couldn't open a bank account. friends would do stuff like that for me. So I had some experience with that. But it also brought back to mind some of the things that I came across in doing this research about this time period, of how, for example, train workers were trapped in that sector. And because some of the workers would stay in the depots and work in the depots, but many of the workers were on the trains, so they were constantly out of town, and they could never really make a jump into another sector, another industry. And so there was some similarity with that. And I think we're also seeing that happening, for example, in many fields where there's a high level of contingency. So, one thing that did come up last night with the public school teachers is I think it was Tithi that mentioned how in some of the surveys of those teachers that went on strike, some of them had as many as 6 jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think what was missed with that was that it's not that they're working 6 different jobs, it's that many teachers are increasingly contingent workers. So they're teaching a few classes here and there, kind of like us contingent professors. And we're teaching in several places. I think that model is going down to the public school teachers as well.
Yeah.
And so I think that this idea of trapping workers in a sector has a lot to do with contingency. And I think that that's intentional as well. These workers may not be full-time. They may not be tied to that one employer, but they're tied to the sector because the work is so variable that you can't really make a jump to another kind of job, and so in some ways the contingency is to slow down turnover, right? So workers can't leave that sector as a form of everyday forms of resistance. If they can't organize, they tend to quit, right? And they move to another sector. I think you talked about this very well in your book, in call centers, right? So that's another thing to consider is that, tactically, if workers know they can't jump to another kind of job, then they are maybe more invested to actually organize in that sector. And
you said that in your book, which you said, I'm a full-time, part-time academic.
Yeah.
It's the same with these workers. You've been working for a number of companies, and actually in a lot of the service sector, I would say, like you have that with bar workers, you have that with cleaners, something like 70% of cleaners are part-time. They've never met someone who's a cleaner and has another job or only does cleaning, they were crazy, 50-hour weeks, but they were part-time for 6 different companies.
But there's also a strong historical analogy that we tend to overlook is that, in the railroad sector, and the railroads were the Google of the day. I mean, they were advanced technologically, they controlled the entire economy, every person, every good had to be shipped by railroad, just like every bit of information now goes through Google and these tech companies, right? So the railroads really were the backbone of the economy, and workers who worked for the railroads were also contingent because they were on call schedules. Many times their hours were cut if the railroads' businesses went down, and there were a lot of depressions the last 30 years of the 19th century. So one month they could be working 78 hours a week, and the next month they could be working 20 hours a week. But they were stuck in that sector because they never could make that jump to another kind of work. And their hours were variable, their wages went up and down. So there's a lot, it's essentially we're returning back to that model that Marx describes in Capital, where workers are on bonus pay, they're on, I hear you call it 0-hour contracts. We essentially refer to it as standby, in the United States. And you also made this other analogy about how to encourage workers to do more driving, they would give them that 1.6 bonus, right? And this is essentially the premium, right, of the old factory systems. These premium pay bonuses where they had if you increase your productivity, your pay per piece would go up. And the intention of doing that was to get all the other workers to produce more. And then as soon as everybody started pushing up their pay, because a lot of people realized that's the only way we can raise our pay short of just striking or something like that. And once a lot of workers started doing that, they cut the bonus. Right? And that's exactly what you're describing, right? Is not workers are refusing to drive, so they increase the bonus, and when they get enough, they drop it. It's essentially the same system, it's just that they're doing it in a different way. They're using a new technology to control it. Then they had inspectors, and you know those Taylorist inspectors would go around and they would measure how much are these workers producing, and they would set the bonus for that day. And when the workers all started doing that, they dropped it. And I think that the historical workers' inquiry has a lot to contribute to the contemporary workers' inquiries, because we can see the same tools being used by capital, just in a different form, using a different technological platform, and workers. Tactics and strategies really haven't changed that much. I mean, that you're producing a newspaper and you're circulating it, you know, or that you're using WhatsApp, you know, it's essentially the same thing as using newsletters and flyers and word of mouth and having community meetings in the church. I think we get a little bit too caught up in, you know, how the technologies are different, but the form and the use is pretty much the same thing.
Brilliant. Is that a potential question, Trey?
Potentially.
Okay. Could we turn it into an actual question?
I was thinking, I think there's a tendency when thinking about studying wildcat strikes to think of them as if they almost mirror or at least echo a union form. So you have some kind of like sustained representatives and some centralized way of making decisions develops and what have you. Kind of like the mushroom unions, right? Van Linden talks about them as mushroom unions, and then unions have problems trying to do that. But so you can think about that either in a teleological way, like, oh, this will become unionization, or you can think of it as like, oh, well, the union just needs to come in and drop onto that form for better or worse. You've been talking in some ways about it's worse. How do you see that in the cases you study? Because in contemporary Vietnam, I don't see that at all. And I think that the way wildcat strikes work in Vietnam is not anything, well, it doesn't mirror what a union structure would look like, really, and it's different. And so it wouldn't be easy for, if there was an effective union, to either contain labour or to help labour, whatever. It wouldn't be easy for a union to do that. Because of the way the strike's organised, doesn't work like a union would. Well, I'm wondering your thoughts on viewing wildcat strikes through the lens of echoing a union organisation.
I can take that. You know, in looking at this period, virtually everything that I'm writing about started as wildcat strikes. And one of the problems is that, you know, I think a lot of the communications that were produced by the workers, the records, for the most part have been lost, so we mostly have to read through the historical record, the legislative history, you know, the press accounts and so forth. But I think that, you know, if we look at some of the wildcat strikes that are happening with teachers right now, and some of the other sectors in the U.S., is that those what you called mushroom union? I hadn't heard that term before, but I think that we're too caught up in looking at the organizational form. I think that the act of taking action of refusing to work establishes a kind of record that workers know that from their actions that they can extract some sort of response, they can extract some sort of concession, and then they learn in the process of actually doing that so that they can use it again later. When a specific organizational form comes out of that, you know, that's when you have employers and the state who are going to be looking for a way to harness it, to be able to control it and manage it. But if it doesn't form into a permanent organization, what it does, though, is it leaves the workers with the experience of how they can use struggle to achieve their next objective. And so I think we tend to look too much to what's the if I'm understanding your question right, is what's the permanent organizational outcome from that? And I think we need to be looking at what's the permanent power dynamic that comes out of that. Because a formal organization doesn't necessarily mean that they have power. I belong to several faculty unions that have no power. They have plenty of organization, but no power.
Me too. Yeah.
And yet it sounds to me like, I mean, even though the workers were referring to y'all as the union, they have chosen you to be their leaders. Mm. Because in some ways you're the depository of how the previous efforts of struggle took place. And your response was right on. But at the same time, you're also becoming the model for the fact that we can organize and disrupt and get some of what we want. And I think that that's more important than having a permanent organization. And it's also the lesson of the Wobblies. You know, the Wobblies during this time period, I mean, they were crushed by World War I. But their approach was you organize, you shift the power, you get part of what you want, and then you build to the next level. As soon as you put it down on paper, that's something that you either become complacent about or becomes a means to control you and prevent you from continuing to escalate. So I think we shouldn't fetishize organizational forms, but I think we need to be focused on the power dynamics and how workers learn to struggle. Joe Burns, in his book Strike Back, about public workers strikes in the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, put it very well. He said, it's not the union that builds the strike, it's the strike that builds the union. But what is a union? It's an organization of workers. It's not an organizational type. It's an organization of workers, whatever form it takes. So I think in some ways, you know, what's going on in China a little bit, you're the Joe with the piece about Vietnam. What you're doing with that, I think, of course, they're not going to be able to form a permanent organizational structure, but they have now the experience of struggle as a means to achieve their goals.
Yeah, I wouldn't exactly have to answer that question, but I would just emphasize the fact that career struggles so far have tended towards, you know, they realize that they can't win any demands unless they coordinate their strikes throughout the whole city. And that's how far the struggles themselves have gone. And our role is to increase that coordination and also connect them to workers in the other cities and ultimately in, you know, across internationally, because that's the playing field of these companies, right? And that's the same field that we have to play in. And actually, two weeks ago, saw the founding of the Transnational Federation of Couriers, which was mostly formed of bicycle couriers, but which has brought together workers from UK, Italy, Belgium, Germany,
Finland.
All over Europe. But I just wanted to ask one question to Robert. Something that we haven't talked about much here in our discussions in general about the strike is that the question of political consciousness. Because, like you said in your book, there's a lot of historians of this period who stress the lack of class consciousness of these workers. And a lot of these workers here, for example, Brazilian workers, they go on wildcat strike, thanks. But they campaign for Bolsonaro, you know? They literally vote for a fascist, or proto-fascist, whatever you want to call him. And I want to know, like, in this period, like, what was the state of political consciousness? Were there anti-similarities at all, or are we, like, in a new era in which...
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. You know, I think political consciousness is something that is a very personal thing, and how do you gauge how politically conscious an individual is looking back in history? You can't interview them anymore, right? There's nobody alive who knew them. Many of them were illiterate, so they didn't leave a written record. So, I think it's hard to gauge that. But I think that, you know, what you give is there's a good analogy to that then. You know, it's very likely that many of these workers were, you know, members of the Klan, and yet when, you know, when these railroad workers went on strike, there were black workers and there were white workers, and they supported each other in many cases. You know, they in 1877 they marched through they marched through different neighborhoods in order to call workers out to join the strike. In St. Louis, for example, was very multiracial. And yet the Klan was one of the biggest organizations in St. Louis at that point. So, you know, there's a lot of debate about, you know, whether or not, you know, these workers' consciousness was unrevolutionary. You know, Philip Fawner essentially described the 1877 strike as a series of strikes and not a rebellion. But it, I think it's, you know, for me, it's looking at the actions and the consequences of the actions rather than the intent, the conscious intent or the ideology. You know, in 1877, there was a fascinating aspect to it, is that in the last few days in St. Louis, in East St. Louis, the Working Men's Party took over the cities pretty much. And they pretty much tried to coordinate the strike. They didn't really run the city day to day. But they tried to mobilize and expand the strike and coordinate it in a central way. But some members of the committee were actually racial supremacists, and the workers, as the media reported, were multiracial. There were black and white workers who were involved. There were a number of black workers who were identified by the press as being leaders in various marches and protests, trying to go from foundry to foundry and call workers out. And yet the coordinating committee of the Working Men's Party were all white men. Most of them weren't actual wage workers. And some of them were racial supremacists. So, you know, so you had that same kind of contradictory element there as well. The leadership didn't really match, the self-imposed leadership didn't match the bottom-up leadership of the workers. So I think working, I think consciousness tends to be overrated. And, you know, if we look more concretely at how workers relate to each other, it's more important than what they say about what they're doing.
Okay, great. Any other comments, questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.